Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 748, Update on the Revision of the History of World War II. This program is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2011. In this program, we're going to be once again revisiting the rewriting of history, and that is something that really is quite common, and I think that a rewriting, or at the very least, a reinterpretation of history is fundamental to the imposition of totalitarian governments of any stripe. And in particular, with regard to the Second World War, there has been a steady erosion of the edifice of fact, historical fact, so to speak, and substituting itself, or being substituted for that historical fact, is ideologized revisionist thinking. One of the things that makes it easy for the history of the Second World War to be revised is the fact that most people just don't know very much about it to begin with, aside from the fact that there are many historical, international, and ethnic global complexities that are simply unknown to not only Americans, but a great many people. For example, we're going to be talking in this program about the Baltic states, Estonia in particular. We're going to be talking about Croatia down in the Balkans and the Ustashi. We're going to be talking about the Vlaamsbach and also the Walloons in Belgium. And these are simply names that are unknown and political and ethnic groups that are unknown to most people, Americans in particular. And so revising the history of World War II in such a way as to change the way these particular elements fit into the overall historical mosaic of World War II and fascism is a relatively easy thing to do. With regard to Americans, I'm reminded of Ambrose Bierce's observation that, quote, "War is God's way of teaching Americans geography." Perhaps. I don't know if even God could teach Americans about history, and indeed, an awful lot of people seem to be either willing to forget it or else too tired or too otherwise distracted or occupied to stand against or to repudiate the revision of the history of World War II. Of course, another thing that makes fascism and the history of World War II, which was initiated by that political phenomenon, an easy thing to revise, is that the history itself is fundamentally wrong, at least as far as it's told in this country. In this country, we are told that fascism was an aberration, that it was a bunch of nasty, crazy people hypnotizing everybody and making them all go crazy. But then along came the Allies, and that took care of everything, or it would have, but along came Joseph Stalin, and he hypnotized everybody and made them go crazy, and finally that all ended as well. In fact, fascism, or corporatism, as Benito Mussolini termed it, and he was the originator or the imprimatur of the system, the corporate state was something that was viewed with great favor by many of the dominant political and financial and industrial elements in this country and their associated political forces. Indeed, some of the most powerful industrialists and financiers around the world, and also some of the most powerful religious entities as well, such as the Vatican and other elements of religious ideology, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, were allied with and supported fascism and were inextricably linked with its history of aggression. So the fact that many of the most prestigious and powerful people in our society, in Western society, supported fascism, supported corporatism, liked the idea of the corporate state, and saw to it not only that some of the same fascist elements were put back in power in places like Germany, Italy, Japan, and elsewhere, but also they saw to it that some of the top Nazi and Japanese killers were put to work for the U.S. National Security Establishment under a number of programs that were kept hidden from the American people at the end of World War II. Nonetheless, those programs have borne an unsavory fruit, and much of the bloodshed that has taken place in the decades following World War II is directly attributable to the failure to act or act to accurately and actively oppose fascism and to cleanse it from the global situation. It should really not come as a great surprise to us to see the history of World War II being revised. Brave listeners, hardy listeners, enterprising listeners are encouraged to access radio, AFA program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. That was even before I began talking about the Borman Group, the Borman Capital Network, on the air. But that will give people a long introduction, a long acquaintance with really how the United States lost the Second World War. We didn't lose it on the battlefield, obviously, but we lost it economically and politically. And I am afraid that what we're seeing right now with the budget debate in the midsummer of 2011 essentially represents a fulfillment, or at least a potential fulfillment, of the 1934 coup attempt in which many of this country's high rollers attempted to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Many of these same industrialists and financiers were ardent supporters of Hitler and Mussolini. They sought to replace Roosevelt with a fascist dictatorship here in the United States. And the fact that fascism has been fundamentally misrepresented and as a result misunderstood, and as a result fascism has, and the forces that engendered it have in many ways been perpetuated either as a viable or perceived viable ideology, and or as something, an agenda that many of the most powerful elements in this society see as something desirable, something to be fulfilled. So it really should not surprise us to see the history of fascism and World War II being consciously revised. I mentioned that one of the things that makes that possible in many places is the fact that the facts are simply not familiar to the average American and an awful lot of other people. In the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, fascism came in the form of the German invasions. Actually, Lithuania was a fascist country, the second fascist country in Europe. A coup in 1925 established a fascist government in Lithuania. As part of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the Baltic states were occupied by the former Soviet Union. Their, quote, liberation, unquote, came at the hands of the Third Reich's armies, who then imposed the Third Reich's political agenda with all of the obligatory bloodletting that that agenda entailed. Nonetheless, after the end of the Cold War, we are seeing the revision of the German armies as anti-Bolshevik liberators, unquote. The Nazis made good use of many different ethnic groups because they simply, Germany's not that big a country, and if you want to conquer Europe and the world, you're going to have more troops than the German people could possibly breed. And so they used various ethnic groups as proxy warriors and allies. One of those proxy warriors and allies were the people of Estonia, one of the three Baltic states. The Jerusalem Post carried a story about a commemoration of the German invasion of Estonia as a day of liberation. This article was from the Jerusalem Post of July 11th of 2011. It's by Jeremy Sharon. It's titled, "Nazi Invasion Commemoration Ignites Row in Estonia." The Jewish community of Viljandi in Estonia has expressed its disapproval of an event staged on Thursday in which residents of the city commemorated its liberation, unquote, by the German army from Soviet occupation in June of 1941. Several dozen attended a commemoration service at the city's German military cemetery for the 70th anniversary of the Nazi invasion. The event was organized by the Estonian Sakala Soldiers Association. Quote, "The usual attempt to portray people who collaborated with the Nazi occupational regime as warriors against Bolshevism," unquote, and furthermore, on the day when the mass murder of the citizens of Viljandi and Estonia who belonged to the wrong ethnicity began, appears completely idiotic, Ella Jacobson, chairwoman of the Estonian Jewish community, said in a statement on Thursday. Janika Kresa, one of the event organizers, told the Sokola newspaper of Viljandi that, quote, "The arrival of the Germans is considered the liberation of Estonia, because it was saved from the order introduced in June of 1940, when about 10,000 people were deported to Siberia and the local people were impoverished. The situation of the Estonians became normal," again. Well, I guess if you weren't, again, one of the targeted groups, perhaps. But again, most Americans don't know anything about the Baltic states. Heck, they don't know much of anything about West Virginia, for crying out loud. So it certainly should not come as a great surprise to see the fact that history is being revised in Estonia, basically attracting very little attention, none that I can see in the United States. As I indicated, one of the things that has made it relatively easy to revise the history of World War II is the fact that an awful lot of aspects of that conflict are unknown to a great many people today. The situation in Belgium, in which there are two basic ethnic groups, the Flemish and the Walloons, is one of the situations in which the World War II ethnic divisions and the political reality of World War II and the ethnic divisions that have survived to this day are largely unknown to at least people in the United States and an awful lot of people around the world as well. The Vlaamsbank is one of the reactionary political parties in Belgium that has engaged in a political revisionism. And once again, we are seeing a move to exonerate many of the Belgians who collaborated with the Germans during World War II. Now, again, there were two basic divisions, or there are two basic divisions, ethnic and linguistic divisions in Belgium, the French and the Flemish and the Walloons, and these are French and Dutch-speaking minorities. Both, it should be noted, contributed to the Third Reich and fascist military effort. However, that contribution is now being swept under the rug in the form of a political rehabilitation for many of these same collaborators. This in the context of the ongoing political divisions between the Flemish and the Walloons, and it may be that ultimately Belgium turns into two, perhaps more, countries. From the Global Post, we find the following article by Paul Ames, dateline June 16th of 2011. It's headlined, Belgian Politics Makes Room for Nazi Apologists. It reads in part, SS Guard Fernand Wyss, WYSS, had a particular greeting for new inmates at the Brandon concentration camp. Quote, this is hell, and I am the devil, unquote. He was no idle boaster. During Wyss's years at the camp north of Brussels, the burly former boxer earned a reputation for beating, torture, and the murder of prisoners. Wyss was not, however, one of the black-uniformed Germans who supervised Brandonk. He was Belgian, a compatriot of most of the 3,500 prisoners sent to suffer and die in the grim former fortress between 1940 and 1944. Some 400,000 Belgians were charged with collaboration with the Nazi occupiers after the country was liberated in 1944. Some, like Wyss, were executed. Others were jailed, fined, or deprived of their civil rights. 70 years on, that legacy of collaboration has become the latest battlefield between Belgium's deeply divided French and Dutch-speaking politicians. Political wrangling between the two linguistic groups has left Belgium without a fully functioning government for a year since elections on June 13th of 2010. Now, relations have been further strained by a bill presented in Parliament by a Flemish nationalist party that seeks an amnesty for surviving Nazi collaborators and compensation for their descendants. Previously, such proposals have been rejected out of hand, but this year, with the country deadlocked by the linguistic dispute, mainstream Flemish parties from the Dutch-speaking north have used their majority in the upper house of parliament to ensure that the bill will be debated. At a certain moment, we have to be adult and be ready to discuss these things, and perhaps also to forget because it's the past, said Justice Minister Stefan de Klerk from the center-right Christian Democratic and Flemish Party. We have to forget certain things. That's necessary to reestablish society, unquote. Flemish support for the amnesty debate, along with the minister's comments, has provoked outrage among French-speaking politicians and Jewish groups in Belgium. For us in the Jewish community, like for the veterans of resistance movements and the former deportees, there can be no question of an amnesty. Our answer is no, no, and no in any language, said Henri Benkoski, the first vice president of the Coordination Committee of Jewish Organizations in Belgium. Quote, "It really worries and disappoints us that these big parties have done this for electoral reasons, playing one-upsmanship with the nationalists. It's astonishing and it's shocking," he told the Global Post. During World War II, thousands of Dutch-speaking Flemings and French-speaking Walloons risked their lives fighting with the resistance and against the Nazi occupation of Belgium. However, others on both sides of the linguistic divide worked with the Nazis. Historian Chantal Kesteloot says those found guilty of collaboration total less than 1% of the population. Flemish nationalist extremists welcomed the Nazis, hoping that they would end what they viewed as Flanders domination by Belgium's French-speaking minority. Among Francophones, the Rexist movement gave Adolf Hitler fanatical support, recruiting 25,000 volunteers for a Walloon legion that fought for Germany on the Russian front. Hitler once reportedly told Rexist leader Léon de Grel, "If I had a son, I wish he'd be like you," unquote. By the way, de Grel also became one of the post-war leaders of the Odessa, and up until his death, he was a frequent speaker at the Institute for Historical Review, that is the Liberty Lobby's Holocaust denial institution in Southern California, and one of the epicenters of Holocaust denial. After the country's liberation, the restored Belgian authorities cracked down hard on collaborators. Almost 250 faced the firing squad, and tens of thousands were imprisoned. Some 4 billion Belgian francs, 91 million by the exchange rate of the time, were seized from convicted collaborators. While collaboration is still almost universally condemned by Belgium's French speakers, attitudes in Flanders have changed. Many believe that a vengeful Belgian state was unfairly severe on Flemish nationalists who were not convinced Nazis, but worked with the occupying forces in hopes of advancing their goal of independence for Flanders. In Flanders, numerous extenuating circumstances can be invoked to justify collaboration, unquote, says the amnesty bill introduced by the Flemish Interest Party. The repression that prevailed after the Second World War was without measure and without end a pretext used to strike the Flemish movement, unquote. When the bill came up before the Senate last month, the Flemish Socialist, Liberal, and Christian Democratic parties joined the Nationalist parties in agreeing that it should be debated. Only the Flemish Green Party joined French-speaking parties in voting against the debate. The change in the mainstream party's reaction can be explained by growing electoral support for nationalists who were split into the hardline Flemish Interest Party and the more moderate New Flemish Alliance, which emerged as the Flanders region's biggest political force in last year's vote. So once again, in Belgium, we are seeing the past being revised under the rationalization or behind the rationalization that such a revision is necessary in order to adjust the present. And yet another example of not only historical revisionism, but at least from an American perspective, historical revisionism, which is an easy thing to perpetrate simply because Americans know nothing about the political realities involved here. And that concerns Pope Benedict's recent statements on behalf of Cardinal Alois Stepanak. He was obviously a Catholic prelate. He was a member of the Sabor, that was the Croatian Ustashi Parliament, and that was the governing body that served under Ante Pavelić, and, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia was anything but. It was a brutal puppet state of Nazi Germany. And as was the case with many of the occupied countries, including Belgium, the Nazis took advantage of existing ethnic and, in some cases, religious divisions in order to effect the classic divide-and-conquer scenario. In Croatia, the Ustashi, the brutal fascist party of Croatia, engaged in liquidations of Serbs, Gypsies, and Jews, and their Jasenovac's concentration camp was a converted brickyard in which they didn't even bother gassing the inmates. The inmates were simply herded into kilns and burned alive. And these were the kinds of activities that were overseen by Bishop Stepanak and Pope Benedict, himself, an individual with a very questionable past with regard to collaboration with the pro-fascist Vatican elements. Pope Benedict has once again engaged in a revision of the history of the Balkans during World War II. He has had some very kind things to say about Archbishop, later Cardinal Stepanak, who again was a member of the Ustashe Parliament, the Sobor. From Global Research of June 9th of 2011, this particular article is datelined at Belgrade and Washington. It's headlined, Holocaust Survivors Denounce Pope's Croatia Statement. It reads in part as follows. The American Gathering of Jewish Holocaust Survivors on June 6th blasted Pope Benedict XVI over his statement about World War II Croatian Cardinal Alois Stepanak. The spiritual leader of the Roman Catholics claimed during his visit to Zagreb that Stepanak, tried and found guilty of collaboration with the fascist Ustasha regime of the independent state of Croatia, was a defender of Jews, Orthodox Christians, and anyone under persecution. By the way, that is a flat-out, bald-faced, total 100% lie, that the notion that he was a defender. In fact, he was a scourge of just such people. Continuing with the article, the Ustasha regime ran death camps, including the largest, Jasenovacs, where Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies were slaughtered. Stepanak, beatified by Pope John Paul II in 1998 as an adored personage in Croatia, unquote, according to a beta report citing AFP, or Agence France-Presse. Visiting Stepanak's grave in Zagreb, the Pope said this cardinal, quote, knew how to resist totalitarianism in all its forms. As a defender of Jews, Orthodox Christians, and any persecuted group under the Nazi and fascist dictatorship, and an advocate for believers and persecuted and murdered priests under communism. The American Gathering of Jewish Holocaust Survivors and their descendants denounced the Pope for honoring Stepanak, recalling that the Zagreb cardinal was a passionate supporter of the Ustashe, whose brutalities were so extreme that they even shocked some of their Nazi masters. And in For the Record program number 508, Der Panzer Kardinal, Pope Benedict, formerly Cardinal Ratzinger's, his own very questionable past, is examined in considerable detail. By the way, the first of a massive five-part AFA series dealing with fascism in the Vatican is available for download for free in the anti-fascist archive section of the Spitfire website. There are also numerous For the Record programs dealing with the fascist Vatican connection, including For the Record 532, an interview with John Loftus. In Germany itself, the Vertriebene groups, those are various groups of ethnic Germans who were expelled from parts of Eastern Europe following the end of World War II. Those ethnic German communities were a prime source of destabilization and agitprop by the Third Reich and were the pretext for the Third Reich's invasion and conquest, to a large extent, of many of the areas in Eastern Europe that came under the Nazi whip during World War II. Following the end of the hostilities of World War II, those ethnic Germans, many of them anyway, were expelled forcefully in many cases, and there was considerable loss of life. But this, frankly, as regrettable as all acts of war are, that was small potatoes compared to what they had helped to engineer for the people who had to endure the Nazi yoke during the occupation of Europe. A person close to the Vertriebene groups and also a German cabinet minister is Erika Steinbach, and she weighed in late 2010 with a very interesting claim, which is that it was the Nazis did not start World War II. It was actually the Poles. And the Expelle Ministry is basically the German ministry that it oversees the Vertriebene groups, which came under the stewardship of the SS during the end of World War, during the closing phase, of World War II. And recently, Erika Steinbach, the ministry, the minister, the head, the German minister of Expelle, had some interesting things to say about the start of World War II. This is from The Independent, a British paper from, oddly enough, September 11th of the year 2010. Merkel ally quits after claiming Nazis didn't start war, by Tony Patterson. It reads in part, in Poland, she remains Germany's most hated living politician. Her unashamedly revanchist political views once prompted a Warsaw news magazine to portray her on its front cover clad in a sinister, swastika-covered Nazi SS uniform. But yesterday, Erika Steinbach, probably the last surviving bete noire in Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative government, took the first step towards bowing out of politics altogether after she started an explosive row over who is to blame for starting the Second World War. Ms. Steinbach, 67, announced her formal departure from the leadership of Ms. Merkel's Christian Democratic Party after enraging Germany's Central Council of Jews by inferring that Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 was merely a response to Poland's military mobilization earlier that year. I am beginning to get the impression that you can't say what you want in Germany anymore, even if one is talking about facts, unquote, is how the veteran right-winger responded to criticism from within her own party and its liberal coalition partners about her remarks. A Polish government spokesman said her comments were identical to, quote, Nazi propaganda, unquote. Historians hasten to point out that Poland's mobilization in early 1939 was a response to the Nazi regime's massive rearmament program. But Ms. Steinbach maintained that she had made her remarks to support her own organization, Germany's 2-million-member Expelle Association, which represents the estimated 12.5 million Germans who were forced out of Eastern Europe after 1945. And I would note again that as outlandish as the claim may seem, in fact, there is considerable political gravitas wielded by people like Erika Steinbach and the Vertrieben groups, the Ministry of Expelle and associated elements, and they are not dissociated from the mainstream German power structure. Indeed, as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, fascism itself is not something that is divorced from the dominant power political elements and their associated economic engendering elements in the United States and elsewhere. More about the Vertrieben groups and their pressing of revisionist politics from the Federal Republic from the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter, which is accessed on the front page. It feeds along the bottom of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. We read the following. With their public statements, two auxiliary board members of the Flight Expulsion Reconciliation Foundation have caused the current scandal. They had been nominated last July by the German League of Expelle and elected to their functions by the German Bundestag. One of them, Arnold Tolg, told BDV regional chairman in Baden-Württemberg that he had told a right-wing weekly that, quote, while the victors were rightfully putting the German war criminals on trial in Nuremberg, those same countries, Poland, Yugoslavia, the Soviet Union, had committed crimes similar to those committed by Hitler's Germany in regards to slave labor. The other, Hartmut Senger, vice president of the BDV, that's the Bundesamt der Vertriebene, the BDV regional organization in Hesse, and a lecturer in adult education at the BDV, suggested in a news article that Poland could share the blame for launching World War II. In addition, he claimed that it was Great Britain who turned it into a worldwide conflict with its war for Danzig, which then became a global conflict when the USA entered, unquote, because of its interests in the Pacific. More about the rewriting of the history of World War II in Side 2, because this concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 748, Update on the Rewriting of the History of World War II. This program is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.